Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Welcome, my friends. We got an extra special episode today. Our returning and much requested guests are Louie and Cuppy. Today's episode, we start by covering the macro landscape and then dive into some key themes Louie and Cuppy are focused on. We talk about emerging markets, the energy transition impact on commodities like oil and uranium, and stealth bull markets in places like Japan and India. We also touch on the Mag 7, Argentina, Turkey, and even aviation sub-assembly stocks. I think that's a first for the podcast. This episode is sponsored by our friends at YCharts. Whether it's their monthly market wrap, top 10 visuals resource deck, or their quarterly economic summary, YCharts consistently arms advisors with the content and tools they need to turn their investment strategies into powerful discussions that truly resonate with clients. With Q1 behind us, YCharts will soon release their economic update visual deck covering topics ranging from market insights to interest rates, macroeconomic data, all packaged in a client-friendly PowerPoint deck that easily breaks down trends for more effective client and prospect meetings. See how YCharts can be your go-to resource for discussing the state of the markets. With templates and downloadable visuals, you can seamlessly incorporate into proposal reports or presentations to not only engage, but also to educate clients on their financial goals. Click on the link in the show notes to grab your copy of the visual deck and follow along when you register for YCharts Economic Update Q1 2024 webinar on May the 2nd. Don't forget, get 20% off your initial YCharts professional subscription when you start your free YCharts trial and tell them Meb sent you. New customers only. Please enjoy this episode with Louie and Cuppy. Today we got two good friends back on the show. Louie and Cuppy, welcome back.
Hey. Thanks for having us. Great to catch up with both of you.
We were just chatting on the intro. The three of us can all turn our cameras around to see different seas. Tell the listeners where we find each of you guys today, starting with Louie.
I'm on Vancouver Island, and I'm looking at the Georgia Straits right now.
And I'm in Rincon, Puerto Rico, and I guess I'm looking at the Caribbean.
If you guys don't follow Cuppy on Twitter, you should, and not for the J-Pal memes, which, by the way, your most popular tweet from last year was something along the line of, hey, a-holes, I'm going to keep raising rates until you guys stop trading monkey JPEGs or something like that, which was great.
Did you see that Bloomberg reappropriated it and used it as one of their own pieces of content?
Well, they're soulless at this point, you know. not just traditional media just is willing to, you know, kind of cut and paste at this point, but that's great. At the very least, you can take pride in being copied. But what I'm saying is you don't follow Cuppy for his great memes. You follow him for his landscaping tips and all the work that you've been doing on your property. Tell the listeners, you live in Puerto Rico on a little surf break called Rincon, but you've had quite the property development over the past couple of years. I've been there. It's beautiful on top of a hill, but tell us a little bit about it.
I live in a little town of about 15,000 people called Rincon. I love Puerto Rico. I go surfing. I went surfing this morning. It's super pretty out here. And I recently bought some land and I started a little farm. It's called Finca Cuppy. Right now we have three cows. They're keeping the weeds down. I've planted some fruit trees that all look dead. I'm running some irrigation lines out there and hopefully we can save them. And then I mostly go and clear the brush all day, but it's tropical. So if you don't go every week, the brush is about as tall as me by the end of the week. But it's been an adventure. I'm learning.
I'm looking forward to Cuppy Farms starting out to be able to buy some stuff on your marketplace. We might as well start talking about investing at some point. I figured we'd start with Louie because he's got a special way with words in a slightly different way. You wrote a recent piece that hopefully will be out by the time this publishes. But you had a great line where you're talking about the Ottoman Empire, where they were on a branch and sawing off their own branch. And I thought that was such a good description. I feel like as a lead-in, can you tell us what you mean by that? What is that? What are you talking about?
Yeah, so, you know, the Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Empire in 1454, and that was a disaster for Western Europe, because all of a sudden, basically, Western Europe was cut off from the spice route, the Silk Road. And if they wanted to buy anything fancy, they had to go through the Ottomans, who jacked up all the prices like crazy. But what that ended up doing, of course, is it created the incentive for Europeans to get on ship and try to find a new route. So Vasco da Gama went south and around Africa. Christopher Columbus went west, eventually hit the Americas. And the Ottoman Empire, by basically trying to squeeze Europe, ended up making Europe the center of the universe for 400 years, 500 years. It ended up, of course, leading, you know, to the capture of all the America's gold, to the slave trade, and eventually to industrialization in Europe. And the Ottoman Empire, by imposing these trade restrictions, in essence, wrote itself out of history. Now, the parallel I was drawing is fairly obvious today, where we're trying to block China's trade, and not only China's, but also Russia's. In so doing, we've basically thrown them into each other's arms. We've kind of officiated at Russia and China's wedding, which is, I think, a geopolitical mistake of epic proportions, because Russia produces everything China needs and China produces everything Russia needs. And the genius of Kissinger and Nixon was to have split those two guys apart. And we've spent the past 5 years basically getting them back together. And that makes for a very different world. Now, I think we believe that we can do this because we've got tech supremacy. I think one open question, and that's another piece I sent you, Meb, is whether we're going to maintain this tech supremacy when every year China produces more new engineers than there are engineers in the U.S. When China is now graduating 12 million graduates a year and, you know, almost half are STEM. For us to believe that we're going to keep this tech supremacy, given this widening educational gap, you know, perhaps not over the next 5 years, but over the next 20 to 30, it seems short-sighted.
Cuppy, you talk a lot about geopolitical macro. Do you have any general thoughts on what Louis is talking about, or are there other areas of the globe that are on your brain today?
Well, I'm not a China expert. I defer to Louis on that. But I agree completely that we've totally screwed up our geopolitical space. We put China and Russia together. It's one of the most harebrained things we've ever done. And China keeps running laps around us in everything we try to do. And honestly, we don't try to do much these days. We've kind of surrendered to the kids' table. I don't know what to even say or think about it. But, you know, the Western world's just kind of a joke in very many ways. And we're resting on, you know, past glory and past wealth as we consume that wealth. And, you know, I think the future is kind of in the Eastern world, and we're on the wrong side of the Iron Wall suddenly. It's kind of scary.
Well, I mean, part of this discussion is a topic that I think investors struggle with, which is currencies and the dollar. It looked like the past year or so, we were at a major inflection point for the dollar, and then it's kind of jiggled a little bit. Do you guys have any general thoughts or opinions on, you know, kind of the prospects for the dollar? I'm trying to plan my travel for 2024, which is like the only way that people really think about currencies, I think, as Americans. The rest of the world is very currency forward, front-minded, but US, I think it only comes up when you're looking at exchange rates for travel. What's y'all's perspective? Is this a long-running, stomping US bull going to continue, or are we finally in a different regime?
For me, there's two things that are capturing my attention. The first is, you know, if you go back to the horrible events of October 7th, you know, Biden made a big speech affirming U.S. primacy. And in essence, he said, look, of course we can fight a war in Ukraine, and of course we can fight a war in the Middle East. We can do those at the same time. Hell, with the United States. And the initial reaction of the bond market was to sell off, and the dollar was to sell off. It was almost as if the market was saying, yeah, sure, you can fight two wars, but we'll tell you at what price. And, you know, since then, of course, bond yields have come back down and the dollar has rolled over. Now, so I'll park that aside, but I just want to highlight this. The second thing I want to highlight is that When you look at the FX markets today, we all look at it through the prism of the dollar, of course, because to your point, everybody around the world measures their currency against the dollar. You can walk into a cab in Jakarta and ask what the exchange rate to the dollar is, and they'll give it to you within a decimal. You know, everybody knows their exchange rate against the dollar. The real, though, if you think, look around the world and you think of what's the one price that's completely out of whack in the world, that's completely wrong. That, you know, 2 years ago, bond yields were completely out of whack. It was completely stupid how low bond yields were everywhere. Today, when you look around the world and you say, what price makes zero sense? It's not as much the dollar as it is the yen. You know, the yen at 150, you were saying, where do I go spend my holiday? Go to Japan. Like, go to Tokyo. You know, it used to be that when you went for dinner in Tokyo, you needed a second mortgage just to pay for the dinner bill. Now you go to Tokyo, not only do you get the best food in the world, it's half the price of New York City, which in my life has never happened. You know, you get food that's three times as good for half the price. All of a sudden, it's to the point where you can't spend money in Japan if you tried. Now, you know, before you used to say that of Indonesia or, you know, Poland or wherever. Japan is, depending how you measure it, the second or third biggest industrial country in the world. To have a country, the importance of Japan, have such a cheap currency creates economic and financial market imbalances. And so, you know, for me, that as I look at 2024, that to me, that's the single biggest question is, does the yen stay where it is?
Let me just interrupt real quick, because I need it to stay this way at least through February for my annual ski trip. We go to Japan, and we've been doing this for many years, and I need to stop talking about it, because every powder magazine I open now, or even in the Wall Street Journal this past weekend, they're talking about skiing in Japan. So I need to be a little quieter, but we were looking at a lot of the prices, and like you mentioned, was actually having a debate with my wife, because skiing, and I grew up in Colorado and loved to ski, but it is so insanely expensive in the United States for lessons, for just gear, for, you know, the passes, everything. And we were having a conversation where I was like, you know, would it be cheaper for the entire family to fly to Japan to ski than it is to go to Colorado? And the answer was yes, and not even close. And so we're debating it.
And it'd be more of an experience too.
Yeah. Why is this persisting and how does it resolve? Because I was looking up my Ned Davis purchasing power parity in Japan. Every country in the world currently had the biggest purchasing power parity. I mean, Turkey, I think, was like number two, and Egypt. You know, like you usually don't see Japan in that sort of conversation. How does this resolve and why is it persisting?
That's the single most important question, macro question, as we look at the current year is, does it continue or not? So, the reason it's there, of course, is the interest rate differential. It's the higher yields in the U.S., especially at the short end. So, you know, do you think that that gap at the short end continues or not? But there's another impact. It's going to be harder and harder, I think, for the yen to stay at 150 because Japan's trade surplus is now starting to improve meaningfully. So they're now starting to get proper inflows. There's always a sort of two-year gap between a currency devaluing and the impact on trade. Because, you know, most businesses hedge their currency risk for a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years. But also, if you're, I don't know, using a Korean-made part, but the Japanese-made part is now cheaper in your car, you know, it takes a while to retool, right? You're not like, oh, this month, this is cheaper, so I'm going to use Japan rather than Korea. No, you know, like supply chains take years to evolve. But once they evolve, then they stay there for a few years as well. So all this to say, economically, I don't think we've yet felt the impact of the 150 yen. Just to your point, you're just starting to see now people saying, oh, maybe I should go ski in Japan. Like nobody was doing it last year. This year, you're going to have a lot of people on your ski runs. And it won't be just Americans. It'll be Chinese. It'll be Europeans. All these things take a little while. But the coming year is where the impact starts to be felt on the Japanese economy, on the global economy. Now, a yen at 150 is profoundly deflationary for the rest of the world. If that changes, that moves back to being inflationary. We've had the deflationary hit. So imagine what inflation would have been like if the yen hadn't been at 150. Imagine now what it's going to be if we go from 150 back to 120 or 110 where it should be. Now, to the extent that the U.S. is in a bull market, that, you know, max 7 goes up every week, etc., you can say, well, the Japanese savers are going to take their money and plow it back into Microsoft. So as long as that goes on, then you're fine. If that stops, then all of a sudden you're like, well, why am I holding these stocks that are going down when I can own, I don't know, Hitachi or Komatsu at home, and those stocks are doing great.
Yeah, it's just like the challenge of an entire generation that's kind of grown up with no Japanese equity returns. As that does potentially shift, you know, it could be, you know, we certainly see a lot of Japanese stocks show up on our screens as being cash flowing and starting to change the governance as far as dividends and buybacks. I was laughing as you were talking about skiing last year, because the night before we went skiing in Japan, our guide broke his femur. And we went over unguided, in which means you have to drive these tiny Japanese vans in like 10 feet of snow in Hokkaido on the left side of the road through a roundabout, which was a good exercise in trying to get around not speaking Japanese. But my favorite part of that story, and he's fine now, listeners, but we're going skiing with him again this year, was that he was like 6'2", and they didn't have rods long enough in his size, because everyone in Japan is shorter, so they had to fly in some rods from Tokyo to stitch him up. Anyway, listeners, if you want to do a meetup in Japan, let me know. It's been a while since we've done one. Cuppy, I don't think anyone's ever said this about you, but you've been so quiet. We got to let you get in some words. I know you think about international investing a lot. We sat on a rooftop in Puerto Rico and chatted about international and emerging investing last time we were hanging out. What looks interesting to you? I've read all your letters. I don't see you talking about Japan. I see you talking about some other far-flung places. Anything front of mind for you today?
As you said in the pre-show, I was just going to nod and agree with Louis most of the show. So I've been mostly doing that. No, I mean, look, I probably should be paying attention to Japan. I actually thought it was funny. All sorts of little pico cap companies are always emailing me, hey, Cuppy, look at this. Hey, you know, I want to have a call with you. But it's always like cannabis companies or junior mining or some pharma thing. And I just never respond. And for the first time ever in my life, a Japanese company reached out this morning. So that's interesting, because I always assume Japanese companies hate IR to the point of, you know, just not even responding to emails. The fact that they're doing like outbound, it just totally changed, you know, the whole narrative for 25 years in my head of Japanese companies. So maybe I should be looking more at Japan.
I'll make a quick point on this. I think, you know, you said one generation of no returns. It's really been two, right? Because it's been 30 miserable years. And, you know, from that, I think indeed comes the impression that, look, you know, Japanese companies are terrible shareholder value creators. And, you know, they have so many things they care about, i.e. employment and their community and this and that, rather than shareholder returns, all of which is, by the way, true. But I think all of that was also amplified by the fact that you were working in a deflationary environment, and now you're not anymore. So, you know, managing a business when it's minus 2% deflation and managing a business when it's plus 3% inflation is night and day. It's really not the same thing. So today, you know, everybody's running around Japan and thinking, oh, these guys, you know, they're doing a better job at creating value. They're doing a better job at, you know, maybe these guys finally get it now, et cetera. I'm personally sort of skeptical on that. I just think we've moved from minus two to plus three. And it's a whole lot easier to manage at plus three than at minus two.
But they actually, the Japanese, and I hate to generalize, but I have friends that follow us a lot more closely than me. And it used to be the joke that the guy who was doing like 9 basis points ROIC was the best performer in Japan. And he was just putting his money in like a money market account. And, you know, he traded as a net-net. And the core business was an okay business. And all the cash just kept piling up. And they never did dividends, never did buybacks. They just put it all out there at 9 bips. And now it seems they're starting to do dividends and buybacks and actually, you know, starting to allocate capital intelligently again. I know this is really, you know, a lot of generalizations, but I think that's what kind of drives equity markets. You need people to think the stocks have a chance to go up, and then people start buying them. And once they double or triple, then people start stampeding.
And as you know, nothing helps more than that grandpa in Omaha, you know, putting his stamp of approval on something. And so the fact that he, at least, is looking to the empire.
Wasn't that a great trade? I mean, I see guys go out there and they go, I run $1 billion now and I can't find anything that's cheap to do in value, blah, blah, blah. I run $1 billion, you know, they're crying. That guy runs, what, $250 billion? And he put a few billion each into these Japanese companies that aren't particularly small. They're all triples and they're like 3-year triples. It's incredible. He's, what, 96? And he's probably wearing diapers. He's still running laps around most of the guys my age when it comes to allocating capital. It's incredible. It's just incredible. You know, props to him. He found the trade everyone was missing.
As we move on from Japan, we could talk about it for a while. My favorite was the very first time we went to Hokkaido, we met a Japanese waitress who spoke flawless English, but she did so with an Australian accent, which was a little cognitively weird to handle. But Cuppy, you've been talking about a totally different emerging market. It's hard to even call them emerging because sometimes they float into the frontier depending on what sort of crisis they're going through once a decade. But the equity market in Argentina, is that something, you know, they just had a pretty dramatic election outcome and with their head of the country. Talk to us a little about Argentina. Is that still interesting to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I wish I hadn't sold. I mean, Argentina has three rounds of elections. And I bought some quite a lot, actually, before the first round. And my guy, Milei, did very well in the first round, which is kind of the primaries. And then he didn't do so well in the second round. And now I'm an inflection investor. And that means when the strength of the trend turns down, so second derivative down, you exit. And I exited it. It's kind of a break-even trade. I was up a little bit of money over a couple-month holding period. I do this a lot, you know. I go in, I go out. And then Milei did quite well in the third round, and all the Argentine equities are up 50 to 75%, and everyone's super excited about him. I mean, I'm excited about him. It remains to be seen if he can actually accomplish anything because he doesn't control the Senate or Congress. But, you know, seems like a very forceful guy, and it comes down to if the Peronists want to just, you know, stonewall him for 4 years and light the country on fire so they have another chance to come back into power, which is usually what socialists do, or they actually want to see the country go forward, in which case, you know, they work together and things go forward. I think it's going to be sort of a bit of both. And I worry that he doesn't have enough of a mandate, really. You know, he won by 10 points, but that's not always enough to, you know, really govern, especially if we don't have the houses. But look, Argentina's hit absolute rock bottom. They're having an economic crisis. I think almost anything is incrementally positive. And no, I think it could be really quite interesting there. I mean, I wish I had exposure. It's up a lot. I got the thesis right and didn't make any money.
Yeah, well, that's better than the opposite, getting the thesis right and losing money. You know, you mentioned the word inflection point, and we haven't mentioned this word yet today, despite it being a topic that seems to be pretty quiet in my circles. Y'all run in a little slightly different circle, so maybe it's a little more front of mind. And I know my Aussie and Canadian listeners will perk up here, but gold is something that seems to be creeping on all-time highs in the U.S. dollar as we record this, the end of November. Yeah, so by the time this publishes, it'll probably be back down at 1,000. What do you guys think? Is this an environment that seems conducive? It seems like we're like waiting on Godot here.
I feel like the Thanksgiving turkey. I'm so stuffed full of gold.
Oh, okay. Well, talk to us about it. Is that a thesis you like?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm a gold bug at heart. And gold's one of these products. It trends for a couple of years, and it does nothing for a bunch of years. It trends again. And look, 2,000 is a magic number in U.S. dollar. I don't know why it seems to pause at 2,000. You know, you can go on the internet and find a billion conspiracy theories, and maybe they're right because all the other conspiracy theories came true this year. But, you know, maybe 2,000 is just, you know, where the ceiling is. I don't know. But we're back through 2,000. I'm not much of a chart guy, but I know you don't have quadruple tops. It's not really a thing. And I think we're going to start trending again. You know, we're a country that's addicted to fiscal deficits and money printing. I think we're going to have some sort of multi-layered crisis. And I'd like to talk about this because, you know, Louis and I see things very similarly on the fiscal side. But it's going to be a monetary crisis and a fiscal crisis and a bunch of other crises of confidence in all the various systems. And when you have a crisis of confidence, you buy some gold.
You're expressing this through the miners, through the actual metal.
Oh, I'm playing a wild man. I own the GDXJ.
For listeners, that's the small cap miners.
Yeah, and I own GDX and I got some calls on them. I don't know. By the time this airs, I probably already lost all my money. But look, miners destroy capital for like 9 years in a row, and then they all go up 2-3 times, and they go back to destroying capital again. But when gold is moving and gold has one of those runs where gold goes a couple hundred dollars in a straight line, these things have huge beta to it. And it's just a trade. I wouldn't wish miners on anyone as a, you know, equity portfolio position, but they do trend. I mean, I haven't seen it happen in a decade now, but they do trend. And I think it's good trade. I think what's super interesting is that, you know, I'm pretty active on Twitter. I'm active in social media. I have a ton of friends in this industry. I talk to all the time. And my friends tend to lean, you know, gold buggy, I guess, for lack of a better word. And we're $30 from an all-time high, and I haven't gotten an email yet all month. Hey, Cuppy, what are you doing in gold? Are you looking at gold? Go on Twitter. I just put two tweets out there just to test the water. No one even engaged with me. You know, if I tweet about uranium, I get 1,000 likes in 3 minutes. Tweet something on gold, and it's just a ghost town. And with $30 from an all-time high, that usually tells me that it's probably going to go. I mean, look at GLD, which I think is indicative of portfolio managers in the U.S. I mean, the units outstanding are down dramatically over the last 2 years. It's a straight line as they have redemptions. So what's driving gold? Well, it's China, Russia, India, every other country buying the gold off American investors. And when Americans come back into this market, I think it's going to stampede gold. It's interesting, actually. It's something cultural. You know, I have Chinese friends, I have Indian friends, and when gold pulls back, they buy on the pullback. My American friends buy breakouts. I'd rather buy it cheap. That's just my mentality. And that's kind of how my Indian friends think about it. But the Americans, you know, when it gets to 2100, they're going to be chasing.
I was going to make that point in that if you look at where physical demand for gold is, you know, basically 2/3 of global physical demand is the broader Indian subcontinent and China. And yes, they buy when it dips. They also buy when they're doing well. You know, it's if you've got spare money, you put it in gold, either because you don't trust your banking system or you don't trust your political system, whatever the reason. Like, Americans don't buy physical gold, by and large. Like, you know, how many people do you know actually own physical gold coins? But in China, in India, if you're rich, you own physical gold. And the richer you get, the more you're going to buy. Now, to the extent that the Indian economy this year is powering along, it really is. You know, we've talked about the Japanese bull market. If you look around the world, there's been only a few bull markets with assets keep on making new highs. We talked Latin America, which is another bull market. Japan's a bull market. Obviously, Mag7's a bull market. Everybody talks about that. Cuppy mentioned uranium. That's another bull market. These have been the 2023 bull markets, but India's been one of them. As India gets rich, they buy gold. So that's the first thing. As China gets richer, now, most of the Chinese economic data bottomed in the second quarter, and it looks like China's picking up again. So at the margin, that's marginally supportive for gold. So you've got already your big market for gold is doing better. Now, 2/3 is there. Another 20% is the Middle East for physical gold. And this is where I think something very big has happened and nobody's even mentioned in the US, is that about 10 days ago, the Saudi central bank signed a swap agreement with the PBOC, with the Chinese central bank. Now, imagine you're a Saudi prince or you live in a world that's fully dollarized. You know, you produce oil, you sell it for US dollars, your currency is pegged to the dollar, etc. And then you see your central bank sign a swap deal with China. You think, why the hell are we doing this? You know, what's the bigger play here? Is the bigger play that we're going to depeg? Is the bigger play that we're going to move some of the pricing of oil in renminbi? Is the bigger play that we're going to move more into the Chinese camp away from the US dollar, away from the US camp? Unless you're MBS and MBS knows what the play is, but if you're, you know, prince number 1,500, you're still very wealthy. You're just prince number 1,500 with no real insight as to what the hell is going on. But you just saw this and you know it's big and you don't know what it means. The default mode is, I don't know what it means, but I'm going to buy gold because gold is making new highs in every single currency in the world except the US dollar. And now it looks like the US dollar is rolling over, so it's probably not going to be very long till gold makes new highs in US dollars as well. So now you've got your three big markets. Your marginal prince in Saudi Arabia is probably buying gold. Your Indian guy is making tons of money right now because it's a roaring bull market, so he's buying gold. And then your Chinese guy is basically stopping losing money. So at least he's probably stopping selling gold to buy something else. So I like Cuppy, I think the environment has changed.
I agree with you guys. The sentiment has been very quiet in my world. You know, sentiment often follows price, I feel like, where, as we saw with all the buffoonery in 2021, people getting very excited about meme stocks and et cetera. But I was trying to see if the only sentiment that I saw was the Costco gold bar, which was selling out, which I had to finally buy a Costco membership. I've never had a membership at Costco in my life. And I bought one just to try to buy a gold bar in Costco, and they're consistently sold out. So listeners, if you bought a gold bar in Costco, let me know. I'd love to hear your story.
That's a very interesting thing, because how much gold did Costco really sell? I really don't think they sold that much. I think it was a great marketing ploy by them. It was.
Yeah, well, they got me in as a member, damn it. I have no interest in being a Costco membership to buy 75, you know, packs of soda or something.
They got you in. They got, I think, a lot of people in. It was a great marketing ploy. It was all over the news for 2 weeks. So it was free advertising everywhere. Great ploy. Very smart.
You've heard about value investing from the likes of Warren Buffett, Peter Lynch, and Seth Klarman, but have you thought about applying those same principles of value investing to fixed income? The Cambria Tactical Yield ETF, ticker symbol TYLD, invests tactically across a variety of fixed income sectors and REITs based on yield spreads to U.S. Treasury bills. When yield spreads are narrow, TYLD intends to hold U.S. Treasury bills. When yield spreads are sufficiently wide, TYLD intends to invest and hold positions in various global fixed income sectors and REITs. Visit CambriaFunds.com/TYLD to learn more. Again, that's CambriaFunds.com/TYLD to learn more. Cambria funds are distributed by Alps Distributors, Inc. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of capital. To determine if this fund is an appropriate investment for you, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risk factors, charges, and expense before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's full or summary prospectus, which may be obtained by calling 855-383-4636, ETF info, or by visiting the website at www.cambriafunds.com. Read the prospectus carefully before investing or sending money. International investments may involve risk of capital loss not associated with domestic investing. Bonds and bond funds are subject to interest rate risk and will decline in value amid rising interest rates.
All right, well, let's get even weirder. Now, while we're in sort of this metal world, I think, Cuppy, you mentioned you get more responses from one topic more than anything, and uranium. I don't know anyone that loves uranium more than you. So let's hear what's going on in this very, what many would consider to be esoteric part of the investing world.
Well, I only do esoteric. Mainstream is hard. I leave that to other people. I like these third tier markets that no one's really paying attention to. And outside of a couple of assholes on Twitter, no one's following the market, really, including a lot of the utilities that are asleep at the wheel and have no idea what's happening in their own market. Uranium is just a supply and demand story to me. We talk about the big picture and the why, but you know, the key fact is that next year, the world is going to produce about 150 million pounds of this stuff. There's going to be about 10 million pounds of secondary production, so call it 160 total. And the demand's going to be 210. That's 50 million pounds. That's almost 25%. If we were drawing 25 million barrels a day of oil, like, this is the only thing we would be talking about globally. But uranium is 15% of world electricity production. It's almost 20% of the United States electricity production. And you're drawing 25 million barrels a day equivalent. It's 25%. And you can ask, how has this been sustainable? And I'd say it's not been sustainable. Utilities have drawn down their inventory now. Since 2019, we've been in deficit. So you have 4 years of inventory drawdowns, and it's gotten to the breaking point, and the price is starting to move.
What is the major driver of that? Is it utility demand? Is it something else?
Well, the utility demand is the story. There's some investment demand on the side, and you know it's going to be very reflexive in a Soros sense, where as the price goes up, investors will invest into publicly traded trusts. There's one called Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, and there's another one called Yellowcake. I own both of them. My fund owns both of them. There's a number of hedge funds set up to invest in this. If you spend about 6 months of your life, you can get regulatory approval to buy it inside of your hedge fund. And I know some hedge funds that have done that now. So you know, this could be reflexive flows as the price goes up. And I think that on the margin, that's going to be additive to the price. But in the end, you have utilities. In most commodities, you use a pound, you buy a pound. You use a pound, it's like your gas tank. You never let your gas tank hit zero, and you usually refill it at about 50%, 30% full, because you don't want to ever go near zero. And with the utilities, it's not the same. The fuel cycle means you only buy fuel about once every 3 to 5 years. You buy a lot of fuel, and then you have to go through all the steps that lead up to fabrication of a fuel rod. And these utilities just held off on buying fuel. And they've ran down their inventories, and now they're at the critical level. And all the utilities at the same time are panic buying, and there's no pounds. There's nothing on the offer right now. The price has gone this year from 50 to 80. There's nothing on the offer. There's like 10 utilities with RFPs out there to the market, being basically two mining companies. And the two mining companies have already sold all their supply. And so I don't know where the pounds come from. I literally have no idea where the pounds come from. And I don't think the utilities know either, because no one's responding to the RFPs. So, I mean, how do you have a one-sided market? It's a bid-only market right now.
How do you think about, I'm not going to ask you about position sizing, but how do you think about this trade exiting? Like, are you a price target guy? Are you someone who just fundamentally reassesses as the story plays out. Give us the, like, you know, this is uranium ETF up 50% since the spring. How do you think about exiting or adding to this position as time goes on?
Well, I don't think I could add. I'm already a little clunky. But look, it's already done well for me. It's outperformed everything else in my book this year. It was started as a pretty damn big overweight. And I don't own the ETF. I just own the physical. Well, I own a little of the ETF, but I mostly own the physical. I like that a lot better than the miners. I really think about it this way. We're in deficit. We have a list of all the mines that are getting built right now. There's a bunch getting built. There's a bunch going through permitting. There's a lot of steps. But from the day that you get your permit, you got to raise capital. You got to do 19 steps along the way. It takes 2 to 4 years. That's even just an existing mine, just turning it back on. Some of these take 10 years to build. And so we're tracking this, and I don't know how it's going to work. You know, you have between now and December of 29, depending on how you model it, it's between 500 million and a billion pounds of deficit. Like, I don't know how this works. I mean, without the lights going out, honestly, because what we've learned with these RFPs that keep coming out, the Koreans just issued an RFP for a second time this month, and no one responded to the first RFP because there's no pounds. There is none. And I don't know how this is going to limp on for another, you know, 7 years like this with the deficits. And, you know, that deficit can go from a billion to 500, maybe to 300, depending on what mines come online, when. The mines aren't coming online. They're all having teething problems, the ones that are in startup. And, you know, the ones that were supposed to come online, they're not producing, you know, to nameplate. Like, no one can get the pounds out of the ground as fast as they're needed. I think it's going to be a problem. You know, I think this game stonks. You know, when you think of the price of uranium, it's 1 or 2% of the price of running a nuclear power plant. It just doesn't really matter. Things like conversion, enrichment, fabrication, you know, just all the other, you know, HR, all the other aspects are far more important than the price of a U308. And I think if the price of U308 went up 20 times from here, it just wouldn't matter. You're talking about a couple pennies, you know, a kilowatt. That just gets passed on to the rate payers, or maybe the utility just eats it, or the government subsidizes it. But you're going to have a chase for pounds because it's not clear if every power plant's going to be able to keep going, which is just based on the current supply-demand imbalance. And I haven't seen anything like this ever in my life. I mean, the only thing I can even think of like this is GameStop, because there were more shares short than existed. And so, you know, you had this like odd calculus equation you can't solve. And here you have more demand than exists in the world. It's the same sort of thing, except for no one needs GameStop. And, you know, I sort of have sympathy for the guys who are short, because it was idiotic what happened. But that was just, you know, a market structure thing. Here, people really need uranium if you want to produce electricity. And like I said, it's 20% of the United States electricity, but it's also, you know, what drives aircraft carriers and submarines around here. And, you know, I think you're going to have a lot of imperative to go find this uranium. And I think the price is going to go up a lot to incentivize it.
All right. So you're slightly bullish. Louis, is the uranium discussion coming up much in your conversations with institutions around the world, or does this tend to be a little more on the sideline topic?
No, I think at first, as Cuppy mentioned, it's esoteric. It's not that big a market. There aren't that many instruments. Either you indeed have to buy the uranium ETF, or you have to buy the miners. The miners, you know, are an imperfect play, and, you know, haven't been the best stewards of capital over long periods of time. And the reason it's not in the conversation is it's not really a big part of anybody's benchmark, right? You know, if Microsoft outperforms the market by 20%, that's a really big deal for everybody, because you're either long or not. But if uranium goes up 10 times, like, nobody cares, because it's not part of a benchmark. Like, I mean, I'm talking the big institutions. If you look around the world today and things that are making new highs, you know, things that are in a clear bull market tendency, I think there's 5 or 6 of them. That's one of them. But again, it's tiny, so people ignore it. There's India. That's tiny, so people can ignore it. There's Mexico, or broader Latin America. That's tiny, people can ignore it. There's Japan. Now, Japan, people have been able to ignore it, because even though it's making new highs, the yen's been weak. So all in all, it's like people have, I think, by and large, ignored it. But I think that one they won't be able to ignore for very much longer, because it is a part of the world MSCI. You know, it is significant. And then there's, of course, the MAG 7 or the Cult 7, and everybody looks at that, because that's like, you know, whatever it is now, 28% of the S&P. And so that one you can't afford to ignore. So everybody just focuses on this one. at the detriment of all these other bull markets. Bull markets that are less crowded, not overvalued, have terrific fundamentals, etc. Everybody focuses on the one that's where everybody is, expensive, and, you know, which leaves lots of opportunities elsewhere.
Returning to what Louis says about expensive, I mean, look, uranium's $80 a pound. I think if you want to run your mine, that's the break-even cost. If you want to produce 210 million pounds and the 225 million they need next year, that's about the break-even price. You're not earning a profit doing it. So how do you even call the physical price expensive for here? You have to have a profit incentive. And I just think, you know, it's still in the low-risk part of the cycle, even though we're 2 years into the bull market and the price has almost tripled.
I don't want to add water to Cuppy's mill, but, you know, if you look at where there is uranium, you know, one place, of course, is Kazakhstan. Who wants to do capital spending there? One place is the Sahel in Africa, where there's a coup every third week.
9 million pounds are offline in Niger. They just had a coup. And by the way, that's in my 160. So if they don't turn back on by January, like we're drawing already from my 160. And then, you know, Namibia is having water issues. So they haven't hit their targets for 2 months in a row. Kazakhstan, they mixed the window before the ground freezes to do their sulfuric acid injections this year because, you know, the supply chain issue. So they're definitely going to miss their targets next year. So you start looking at this and it's just like infrastructure, supply chain, politics, it's all these problems.
The only place conceptually where people would feel comfortable adding mines and getting it out of the ground would be Canada. But here the problem is good luck finding workers, because Canada, like the US, you know, you want to find workers to, you know, type on a computer in Vancouver, that you can find. You want to find guys who go up to northern Alberta, northern Ontario in the winter, you know, good luck. You're not going to find them.
As we talk about all these ideas that no one's paying attention to or paying attention to, I mean, I think one of the most discussed topics in my world, particularly on the end investor side, has just been this elation with T-bills having a yield again. And a lot of people, you know, the phrase of the year being T-bills and chill and just chilling out in 5% yields. But is there any other areas that we haven't talked about thus far that you guys think either are really interesting investors are ignoring? Cuppy hasn't even mentioned oil, which, like, on my bingo card, we should have had, like, you know, at what point will we all say one of these words? And Cuppy not saying oil 45 minutes in, I think, is...
I'm just so excited about uranium. We can talk about oil. I mean,
I don't want to lead it with oil, but just, like, what in general is on y'all's mind, or what are people asking about?
I do bull markets. I do industries that have been starved of capital for long periods of time that have destroyed everyone's hopes and dreams. And everyone just stopped looking because it's been so miserable and sad and depressing. But I tend to look at, you know, decently good quality businesses. You know, look, aerospace has been terrible. You had the issue with the MAX plane, where the planes were falling out of the sky because they programmed it wrong. Then COVID came and no one wanted aircraft. I mean, it's been an 8-year bear market in aviation. But, you know, and I think it's a crazy statistic, but Southwest Airlines, which is like a second tier airline in the United States, between what they own and what they control, they have more aircraft than entire India with over 1 billion people. Just think about that. Southwest Airlines, a smallish airline in America, they control more aircraft than all of India. And then you look at Boeing and Airbus and you see what their backlog looks like. And it's all India, China, Indonesia, Philippines, like this Africa, like this is where it's all coming from. Middle East, they just keep reordering and reordering, you know, Turkey. And just look at the backlog. You have a 10-year bull market, and Boeing and Airbus, they have bottlenecks. They can't figure out how to produce what they plan to produce. They each say, we're going to produce X many planes. We're producing 40% of that right now. And every month, they want to get one more plane done and eventually ramp up to 70 a month. You know, 70 of this model, 50 of that model, whatever. And they're slowly ramping up. And as they ramp up, everything in the supply chain is seeing huge growth in demand for all the components. You know, Boeing and Airbus, they just final assembly. And these factories have really had no business for years and years. And suddenly the business, the backlog, I mean, these companies have 3 and 4 times the backlog they would have had in 2019. It's incredible what's happening. And yeah, you know, they're earning no margin right now because it's really hard to ramp up an industrial business in America. But I think they'll figure this out. And volume usually drives margin. And if not, they'll, you know, get some concessions from Boeing and get more margin. I mean, we own a bunch of these things. They're great. And I just think there's a huge bull market as Boeing ramps up to whatever the target number is. And like I said, I love bull markets that are reasonably good businesses. And for a lot of these aircraft, there's really only one sole supplier.
Aviation subassembly has definitely been the first time that's been uttered on this podcast, probably not certainly just this year, probably ever.
Meb, I think that the thing that makes this far more interesting is that we just gave all our spare toys to Zelensky, and suddenly the U.S. military is outbidding Boeing and Airbus for new equipment. And suddenly it's a price war. Whereas before, Boeing and Airbus kind of collegially worked together, the U.S. military is just outbidding everyone. And suddenly, I think these guys are going to get huge margin next year. And you see it in the backlog, and they have to basically eat through the backlog because you book backlog for 2025 now. So you have to eat through 23 and 24 and then margin. And I don't know. I love this trade. I love bull markets that no one's paying attention to because you can buy into them at 1, 2, 3 times cash flow, 25 cash flow, you know, 2025.
1, 2, 3 times cash flow is always a nice multiple. You don't see that when you're talking about the Magnificent Seven. Louis, what else is on your brain as we wind down 2023? What are you thinking about? What are you worried about? You know, these two big conflicts. It seems like the discussion around Taiwan has receded a bit, maybe not in your world. What are you marinating on as we get to year end?
I don't like being worried. I like being hopeful. I'd like to make a couple points that I think there's misconceptions that perhaps predate COVID. I think when people look at Asia from the United States, they bring two conceptions with them that are wrong. The first conception is that China exports cheap stuff. And the other misconception is that India can't build infrastructure. Now, I just thought of this because I was listening to Cuppy just now about airports, etc. You know, in the past 5 years, India's opened 17 new airports, and they're going to open another 17 in the next five that they're in construction right now. You know, you go to India. I hadn't been to India. I went to India this summer, spent a couple of weeks there. I hadn't been there since pre-COVID. You now have motorways. You have world-class airports, much better than airports that you have in North America at this stage.
Yeah, can we get them to take over LAX and Los Angeles? My God, what a dump.
And so I highlight this, you know, as Cuppy's talking about the lack of planes, et cetera. If you've just built 17 new airports and you're building another 70, you know, you're going to need planes to fly to between these airports. And now that brings me to the next point is in the past, all these airports would have been built using Caterpillars, using, you know, Western, either US or European machinery, tools, et cetera. And the planes for now are still going to be Airbus and Boeings. But in 10 years' time, it's not given that it will be Airbus and Boeing. And in the meantime, you are moving from Caterpillar to Longhorn machinery. You know, China's trade surplus has gone from $30 billion a month 5 years ago to $80 billion a month. And it's not because all three of us have decided to buy three times as many pairs of underwear and three times as many pairs of socks. The reason it's gone from $30 billion to $80 billion is China is now exporting cars, earth-moving equipment, telecom switches, trains, turbines. China right now is negotiating with Saudi Arabia to sell nuclear plants to Saudi Arabia. Now, as a Frenchman, I'm like, how are we losing this business? This is French business. This is like the kind of stuff like we do. But China's going to get this business because, of course, it's doing it cheaper than the French. Now, I highlight all this because, you know, this is super hopeful for the whole world. China today, if you're Indonesia, if you're Vietnam, if you're Saudi Arabia, China's allowing you to industrialize on the cheap. It's allowing you to industrialize on credit. It's allowing you to industrialize in a currency other than the US dollar. It might be in your local currency. It might be in renminbi. And putting at the back end the pipes to make this necessary. So China says to Saudi Arabia, look, let's do a deal on these nuclear power plants. Let's do it in renminbi, and I'll give you a swap line to make sure that you can always have renminbi to pay me. This makes for a world that is much more stable, where trade doesn't depend on all of a sudden JP Morgan waking up one morning and saying, I'm not going to fund Indonesia. I'm not going to fund Saudi Arabia for whatever reason.
You know, on China, are you generally positive on the equity markets? And the reason I ask that is, you know, there's probably been, as far as valuation, no bigger basket case in the markets than, you know, China over the past 20 years has been.
Oh, Japan. Japan as well.
Full spectrum of, like, you know, boom, bust. And arguably, if you look at the long-term PE ratios, China's at or below kind of the lowest valuation, you know, we've seen, if not ever, in a very long time. Are you generally constructive on Chinese equities, or how are you feeling?
I think the biggest misconception of foreign investors when they look at China has been to look at it through the prism of equities. And here, you know, we're all the fruits of our own experiences. But when I started in this business, my very first client, a gentleman called Biat Nott in Nochtuki in Geneva, told me, Louis, remember that when you don't know what to do, when it's panic in the markets, when it's mayhem, you have to buy equities in the US because the Fed will always manage policy for the equity market. And you buy bonds in Germany, so I'm showing my age, but you buy bonds in Germany because the Bundesbank, so the Bundesbank still existed, will always manage the economy for the bondholder because all the Americans own stock and all the Germans own bonds. So deep down, if you don't know what to do, you just do that and you'll be fine. And by the way, if I'd followed that advice, I would have probably done better. But you know, most Americans look at China, think, oh, China's growing, I buy Chinese stocks. The reality, to your point, is Chinese stocks have massively underperformed U.S. stocks. If you bought Chinese bonds, you've absolutely crushed U.S. treasuries. Chinese bonds have been the new Bunds. The PBOC is the new Bundesbank. Why? Because the primary goal of Chinese policymakers has been to internationalize the renminbi, to make it a credible currency. And for that, you need a credible bond market that delivers steady, positive, absolute returns. So we are now in the phase of the cycle where the Fed has done everything it could to goose up the equity market and done it successfully. And, you know, and if that meant that treasury holders got smoked, then so be it. The next thing that will happen is, I think, U.S. dollar holders will get smoked because the equities will need to be saved. And so the U.S. dollar will end up being sacrificed. But in China, what matters more in the order, in the pegging order, is first currency, then bonds, then equities. The equities are the variable of adjustment. So we are now at the stage where, yes, you know, equities are cheap. Yes, all the economic data ex real estate shows that the economy bottomed in the second quarter and is picking up. Yes, the government wants the equity market to come up. So I think it's a dangerous short. But long term, again, if you want to buy something long term in China, you buy the bonds.
If I was to guess, of all the people listening to the show, how many own Chinese bonds, I'm guessing the answer would be, it would round to zero. There are two Chinese bond ETFs. One has 3 million, the other has 33 million in it. And, you know, foreign bonds are largely one of the, if not the largest asset class in the world. It's pretty darn close and astonishing.
China's the second biggest bond market in the world. Second biggest bond market in the world. And nobody owns it. Nobody owns it.
I bang my head against the wall almost every day on Twitter talking about international investing. I was going crazy today because I was getting into it with an institutional investor who says, you know, international investing hasn't worked over the past, you know, lifetime. And I go, let's be clear. International investing has worked great. What you mean by what you're saying is international investing for Americans, but international investing for the other 44 countries around the world that are investable has worked fantastic. So you have a sample size of one out of 45. That's an odd statement, but you know, so
I would say I remember so well in 2000, a piece, I think I'm pretty almost 99% sure it was published by Merrill Lynch. Basically, it was a huge report saying, like, look, international diversification makes no sense. You need to be 100% in the US. And this was in 2000. And then for the next 10 years, 2000, 2010, US basically underperformed everybody. I want to be clear. Today, I look at Chinese bonds. You know, yields have come down a lot. They've delivered terrific returns. They've crushed US treasuries on a 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year view, et cetera. I think if you put money in bonds today, you're much better off owning Latin American debt than either US treasuries or Chinese bonds. You know, you're getting real rates. Today, you can buy Brazilian TIPS offering you 6% real. What else do you need? You can buy Pemex debt, and Cuppy and I have talked about this before, but you buy two-year Pemex debt, you swap it back into peso, it gives you a 16% yield. Like, unless oil goes to $20 and Mexico goes bankrupt, you know, this seems like a fairly, and by the way, I don't think oil is going to $20, just to be very clear.
We're going to have to title this episode, Is It Time to Buy Brazilian TIPS? Which we did a fun poll on Twitter where we said, at what real yield would you sell stocks and buy TIPS? This is in the US. And, you know, they're at whatever, 2.3 now, et cetera. I said 3% real, 5% or TIPS yield, 3%, 5%, 7%, never. you know, and the vast majority of people are like never or seven. So forget the fact that none of those yields have ever been hit, you know, right?
These are levels. Of course you do it all day, every day.
Right. At five, I think. At this point, I feel like people are just trolling me in my Twitter polls and answering like things that they know will set me off. Cuppy's quiet again. So, you know, one of the goals in the beginning of this podcast, we said we have to challenge ourselves and find something that at least the two of you disagree with, maybe all three of us. So as you think about one of our favorite questions, which we've asked you guys before, but to think about maybe in current terms, you know, as you have conversations with your investors and just general media and other pros, let's talk about like the pros is what do you believe right now that the vast majority of your friends don't? And it could be something that is either a specific investment or trade. It could be something that is more like philosophical speaking, anything. This may take a minute to think about.
I believe quite strongly that we can have a recession, though it doesn't appear like we're having a recession. By, you know, the data might be a little softer, but it doesn't seem particularly bad. I believe we could have a recession and the equity markets keep going up. I believe that the S&P, even though, you know, Mag 7 is such a big piece of it, and I don't think Mag 7 goes up much more, I think it can go up because, you know, there is no alternative. I mean, you're not going to buy 10-year. You're not going to put it into money market. What are you going to do with your money? You don't really have any option. And as Louis said, the government's going to be there to bail out the S&P because that's every voter's retirement account. And, you know, if the S&P has a down 20, no one gets reelected. That's how the policy system is set up. And, you know, if you have a recession, it means they print a ton of money and the S&P goes up. If you don't have a recession, retained earnings, they buy back all the stock, the S&P goes up. And if Mag 7 goes down 30%, it goes back to, you know, an index, you know, multiple. Well, then oil stocks re-rate and industrials re-rate and, you know, cyclicals. There's all these sectors that are priced for a recession that never seems to come. And we're 2 years into this process where every month they say next month the recession is going to be here. And then the recession doesn't come. And the jobs data is fine, and maybe leading indicators are slightly worse. And there's always that one data set they drag out, and they're like, look, it's happening. But that doesn't really happen. I believe that no matter what happens, the equity market's just going higher. And I don't think most of my friends think that. I mean, most of my friends are, look, I'm running 130 long right now. Like, and I'm kind of bearish, I guess.
Wait, hold on. Like, can you restate that statement and explain it for listeners? Because I feel like people are like sipping their coffee to be like, hold on, did he just say he's 130 long and bearish?
Yeah, I'm kind of bearish. I mean, the data's starting to get a little tarnished on the edges. But I mean, I'm long, you know, GDXJ, or I'm long, you know, uranium. I'm long things that probably are countercyclical. I don't have any consumer, put it that way. I don't have any like the leading edge stuff, but we have a lot of industrials. And I mean, they're 2 and 3 times next year's cash flow. Some of them are 1 times. Like, come hurt me. Take 30% of my EBITDA, you know, come hurt me. Like, I'm not that worried. I mean, if they hit the stock, there'll just be more buybacks. But I genuinely believe that, one, the economy is a lot stronger because everyone's looking at real data and not nominal data, which is why every corporate beat earnings in Q3. You know, they on the revenue side, it was a little, you know, dicier. But on the earnings side, they were just fine. Because, you know, when you're running 7, 8 nominal, well, yeah, of course you should have 8% revenue growth. That's just, you know, treading water in a real world. And I just think equities going higher as a result of this. And like I said, if equities go down 20%, well, then they print money and equities go higher. I just look at my friends. A lot of them are sitting with a bunch of cash. A lot of them are short. A lot of them are running like, you know, 120-80 or something where they're like 40 net long. And they're just suffering. They've been suffering for 2 years now. And they're their shorts are killing them. They're probably short Mag 7 and their longs at the same value stuff I own that never goes up. And no, I mean, everyone's suffering. And I feel like people are totally mispositioned for the world we're in, which is an inflationary, fiscally stimulative world.
Cuppy and I have very similar worldviews. Let me put it this way. My whole life has been the story of different economic zones integrating. So I grew up in France just when, you know, European Union was really getting going, trade barriers were coming down, and the exciting story was the European Union. Then I moved to the US for college in the early 90s, and that was, you know, NAFTA, and that was an exciting story. Then I moved to Hong Kong just as China was about to join the WTO, and then for 15 years we talked about Chin America. Now, everybody today talks about deglobalization, which to me is completely wrong. There is no deglobalization going. Global trade is still expanding. It's just that we're not part of it. It's not, it, you know, for the first time since Columbus sailed for the Americas, the Western world has nothing to do with the globalization. We're not doing the financing. We're not doing the logistics. We're not doing the capital tools, the machine tools. We're not doing any of it. All the growth in the world and trade is now happening emerging market to emerging markets. And I think people are missing it because they're looking in the emerging markets through the prism of China. Now, China has had a rough 5 years, but because it's had a big real estate boom and a big real estate bust. Having said that, in my career, every time you had a real estate bust, Southern Europe in 2011, US in 2008, Sweden in 1992, Japan in 1991, your economy imploded. Your banking system went belly up. Your economy, unemployment went through the roof, et cetera. China's just gone through a big real estate contraction, and they've kept the show on the road. Banks haven't gone bust. Nobody's gone unemployed. It stayed okay. Now, still, China's been weak. We look at emerging markets through that prism. We need to look at it through another prism. And the prism is that you draw a line from Istanbul to Jakarta. It's 3.6 billion people with incomes growing by 5% a year and population growth by 1% a year. It's capital spending. It's every day that goes by, a new free trade deal, a new railway, a new canal, a new road gets announced. I mentioned the 70 Indian airports, but it's the same story in Indonesia. It's the same story in Saudi Arabia. It's the same story in Turkey. Few people realize this, but since the bottom, you know, for all the talk about how the US, you mentioned international diversification doesn't work. Since the COVID bottom, Mexico and India have outperformed the US, Brazil, Indonesia, even Turkey. Everybody thinks Turkey's this big basket case. Turkey's done just as well in US dollar terms in Turkish stocks as US stocks. And in the past 2 years, Turkey has like crushed the United States in US dollar terms. So the new big story is the story of the Eurasian economic integration, is how from Turkey to Jakarta, you have one big economic axis with more trade, more infrastructure spending. And the question becomes, how do you play this? Do you play this through capital spending? Do you play this through the luxury goods? Do you play this through the commodities? Do you play this through the local banks, the local real estate? There's many ways to skin a cat, but that is the big macro trend, is the economic integration of the Eurasian continent. And I'm not sure, for all the talk about how you got to have all your money in the US, I'm not sure that the US is actually, and US companies are the best position to participate in this. Swedish companies, Japanese companies, Chinese companies are much better positioned than American companies to participate in that growth.
Listeners, if you want to hear more on Turkish stocks, we did an episode with Monish Pabrai where he talked at length about investing in Turkey, which I don't know if we've done elsewhere on this podcast before. So good to hear. Gentlemen, we've been at this for a little bit, and we've covered almost everything I could possibly think about. We've done little very disagreement, unfortunately. Is there anything else that is on your brain that we didn't get to?
Let me bring up iron ore. That's the commodity that was supposed to roll over like 100 times in the last decade, and they just can't touch iron ore. It's bulletproof. It's like met coal, but it's even stronger. I mean, look, China was supposed to have all the steel it ever needs at the end of time, and iron ore doesn't have downticks. I mean, I think that's telling you what's happening in the global economy. They keep building more iron ore mines, keep exporting more. It doesn't matter the price, just bulletproof. I mean, copper, it's hanging in there in the high threes. Like, I think things are just really strong. And I think it's what Louis is talking about, 3 billion people that want stuff. I got a question for Louis. There's a ton of these companies that trade at 1 to 3 times cash flow globally. These aren't pico caps, you know, billion plus market cap. A lot of them have double-digit dividend yields, big buybacks. Yeah, they're clunky businesses. They're, you know, steel or they're iron ore or they're cooking coal or industrial something. They make gadgets. And these things have been cheap for the better part of a decade. They got super cheap during COVID. Like in 2022, they had like a bit of a revaluation period. And I was like, oh, it's happening. And then they just like deflated all 23. The money flowed out back into Mag 7. What do you think it takes for these things to go up? I mean, economically, they're performing very well, but the share prices are just miserable. Is this just, you need the dollar to roll over? Do you need interest rates to roll over? What is it that finally wakes these things up? Because for the life of me, I don't get it.
Either the dollar wakes these things up, but you're right. You know, you've even seen, I'd add one more thing. You've started to see some industry M&A. You've started to see it in oil, right, with the Pioneer deal. And the so you'd think, oh, okay, finally, this is going to bring it to life, but not even. So yeah, look, it's been a place of immense, immense frustration.
That's the word, frustration.
As my dad likes to put it, it's funny but not amusing.
Like I wouldn't be upset. Look, if the businesses were doing poorly, I would say, yeah, that's bad fundamental analysis.
Yeah, I messed up. I messed up.
Every quarter, they just keep plowing and the cash keeps coming in and no one cares.
I mean, one easy culprit is ESG. And you say, like, most people can't buy these things. So they can be given away in the street. People aren't going to pick them up, even if they were free, just because you can't be seen owning those things. And here, you know, there might be a change in the zeitgeist. Just like, you know, in uranium, we've seen a change in the zeitgeist. You know, like 5 years ago, we were getting Chernobyl on HBO telling us that, you know, if you get my favorite part of Chernobyl, I don't know if you watched the series, was the guy, you know, the firemen, the heroic firemen who go in there, et cetera, are then kept in isolation because they're going to be contagious for radiation exposure, you know. And they're like, their families are told you can't see them because you get contaminated, as if radiation poisoning was contagious. So the public was massively against uranium, and that's shifted. It's shifted with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. All of a sudden, people are like, actually, it's kind of nice to have your own power supply and not be dependent on anybody. And I highlight this because on ESG, I wonder if we're not going to start seeing that. It's slow moving, but initially the point of ESG was we told investors, look, you can't buy this. You can't buy any of it. And now what you're starting to see is, I think, a shift where people are like, okay, well, we actually do need copper and we do need iron ore and we do need all these things, but there are more or less green ways to produce it. So maybe BHP is a green producer. You know, they get all the right stamps of approval. And so therefore, like BHP, you can own in an ESG portfolio, but you can't own the Chinese one that pollutes the hell out of the sky, or the Korean one. And so the shift starts to move from you can't own any of them to actually, let's try to be smarter about this and see how different things are produced. And I think there is starting to see that shift in ESG. And perhaps that might help some of these guys, but maybe that's just me, you know, clasping at straws.
I think it makes sense. The ESG stamp of approval, you'll have a whole nother military industrial complex of stamps on stuff.
Oh, for sure. I don't know. Governments will be very happy. It's like, oh yeah, let's do this. You know, jobs for the boys. I'll be head of the copper mining stamp and you can be the head of the iron ore stamp. And maybe Meb can be the head of the nickel stamp. And we'll all need to build armies underneath us to, you know, stamp. And so governments are going to love this.
I was getting into it, as I often do. I love to poke CalPERS, the $400 billion plus pension plan in my home state. And we wrote an article like a decade ago called, you know, Should CalPERS Be Managed by a Robot? We did one on Harvard, largely both of those due to governance issues. And then Bridgewater, but like largely due to the challenges of just how hard it is on a global portfolio at scale of these guys. And, you know, CalPERS particularly triggered me yesterday because they wrote a job description, which I've applied for 3 times. They've had something like 5 CIOs in the past decade. And it's the most laughably, like, you got to make a documentary out of it at some point. But they're paying a consulting firm $300,000 to find the next CIO. And part of the attributes they're looking for are cultural competence, ability to effectively listen, the ability to read the room, present in a way that doesn't cause a furor or that's insensitive to CalPERS culture. And the board would also like the new CIO to agree to receive mentorship. And I was like dying laughing. I'm like, what, like Scott Malpass or like the late great David Swensen? Can you imagine hiring one of these guys and then being like, you know, one of the things you're going to have to do, you're going to have to be mentored. You'd be like, by who? Like, by whom? Like, what, like, like, unless it's Buffett or like, you know, somebody.
Unless it's Warren Buffett or Howard Marks, I'm not taking it.
You need to separate the CIO role and like a press secretary role, which is but my goodness, dysfunctional.
It's good that these mandates exist because it creates alpha for guys like us to pick up off the street.
It creates also a lot of management fees for, I think, our VC friends. They did something like 0.5% on their venture capital portfolio the last 20 years, and then have decided to triple it. They're like, we're so bad at this, we clearly can't be worse.
It was the golden age of VC. Had they lose money?
Right. How could you could have just picked a dart. The favor, though, was when they eliminated their entire tail risk portfolio the month before COVID started. It was like the absolute worst time in the history, maybe like the month before GFC rolled over. But anyway, they do it to themselves, so I don't feel sorry for them. Anything left? I got some more ideas, but I figure we've been boxing and dancing for a while. You guys probably rack up more frequent flyer miles than anyone I know. Do you have a favorite place on your 2024 travel list you're excited to check out?
Louis travels way more than I do. I got to be 183 days Puerto Rican.
I don't know what you're talking about, Cuppy, because you got to start a separate Instagram account for your food travels. I give you credit for dining well. All right, well, give me your hotspot next year.
I'm off to Beijing, actually, in a couple of days. I'm doing Beijing, Shanghai, and Hangzhou. So back in China, I've been obviously in Hong Kong a bunch. That's where my office is, but I haven't been back to the mainland since June. And when I was there in June, people were feeling very despondent and the mood was very, very somber. So it'll be interesting to see if that has changed a little bit.
And that was regarding what?
Well, regarding just the economy, regarding government policy, regarding pretty much everything. Now, what was interesting to me when I was in Beijing was, you know, everybody was super despondent, etc. And a couple of the people I met, I asked, okay, and especially with the real estate outlook, and I'd say, okay, so what would it take for you to buy real estate? And a couple of times they were like, oh, I bought one last week. And I said, oh, well, so you can't be that bad. He goes, oh, yeah, but I got a special deal. Yeah, it was like 20% off. And then like the mortgage rates are half the price, et cetera. I go, yeah, so, okay, the market's starting to clear. And then they were like, yeah, but that's okay. Like in Beijing and Shanghai, you'll clear, but there's like empty buildings, you know, in the middle of nowhere that will never clear. Which to me sounded a lot like I remember in 2009 where people were saying, oh, there's all these empty condos in Florida, Nevada, Arizona that will never be sold and we might as well turn them into chicken coops. And then you came back 3 years later and they were all occupied because, you know, prices go down and mortgage rates go down. And today affordability in China is as good as it's ever been in 20 years. You know, prices have come down 30%, incomes have gone up 30% and mortgage rates have halved. So I'm very interested to see whether the despondency is still there or whether people are starting to pick up a little bit.
Cuppy, where are you going?
I think I'm going to Venezuela. I think I'm going to go check that out. I have a friend who has a property portfolio there. He's been very early in buying Venezuela. I always thought it was a dangerous, kind of screwed up place, but he's still alive and it's been 5 years now. So I feel like, you know, it's time to go see.
Well, I mean, let's be clear, listeners. This is coming from somebody who's lived in Mongolia and is now in Puerto Rico. You know, I'll give you this. Of the nearing on 400 investments I've done on the startup world, my number one, very likely, it's certainly in the top three currently, was a Venezuela company. Just to go to show, you can make money anywhere, but as a look around to the next few years, I've seen probably more interesting deals in emerging markets in the startup world than certainly in the U.S. over probably the past 3 to 5 years. So let me know when you go. I've always wanted to go fish, Los Roques off the coast.
I'll let you know. You can come join. It's look, they're just opening up right now.
So Cuppy, I was just in Chile a few months ago, maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And one of the guys I met there, big billionaire, I just bought the biggest Venezuelan insurance company for $17 million.
is that good or bad?
Well, I think the way you looked at it was a call option, and you know, if you're worth billions and you can buy the biggest insurance company for $17 million.
Yeah, why not? I guess.
And if you think you can probably turn it around in 10 years' time, if Venezuela does any kind of economic readjustment, that thing could be worth a couple billions pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, that the current guy is Maduro. He's trying capitalism because communism didn't work, and things are actually working there. I mean, from a super low base, but it hit absolute rock bottom about 5 years ago, and it's kind of on the way back up. And they might even have elections, and someone else shows up.
The one issue they have is all your sort of middle class, like the guys who worked in petroleum engineers and et cetera, they all left for Brazil and for Colombia.
They'll go back. Most of them are in Miami now.
Yeah, or Miami. But so they've the rich guys went to Miami, the poorer guys went to Colombia and the middle class went to Colombia and Brazil. Yeah, they might come back. They might not. So you've sort of hollowed out your talent pool. But
yeah. I'm curious to check it out. Maybe not invest. I don't know.
No, it'll be interesting. I'd love to hear what you think.
I'm looking forward to Cuppy holding a conference meetup in Rincon to where we can all come visit.
Yeah, let's go do this. So you've already come once and enjoyed RingCon. I'm inviting Louis like 5 times now.
I'll make it because I've got my sister lives in Puerto Rico, so I got to make it down anyway.
Make sure you come before it gets too hot, before May.
We'll get Wes to get all the quant nerds.
Good, let's do it.
Gentlemen, it's been a wide-reaching conversation. It's been a lot of fun. Where do people go to find out more info on you guys if they don't already? Start with Louis.
To our website, which is gavekal.com, GAVEKAL.com.
And for me, go to praycap.com. I got a blog there. It's free, so you get what you pay for. And if you like memes, go to @HCuppy on Twitter.
Perfect. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to see you guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Podcast listeners will post show notes to today's conversation at mebfaber.com/podcast. If you love the show, if you hate it, shoot us feedback at themebfabershow.com. We love to read the reviews. Please review us on iTunes and subscribe to the show anywhere good podcasts are found. Thanks for listening, friends, and good investing.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.